Open up the meeting of the House Business and Labor Committee for the 22nd of March, 2013. Happy birthday, Tom McCall. Tom McCall's 100th birthday today.
By the way, I understand that.
Okay, and I would like to open up the public hearing on House Bill 3352. Jan, if you could summarize it, please.
Madam Chair, committee members, this bill eliminates the requirement that factory and manufacturing employees who work more than 10 hours in a day be paid time and one half for each hour worked in excess of 10 hours. There are no amendments before you, and there's no subsequent referral.
Okay, thank you. Being rushed over here is the
thank you very much.
Okay. I would like to call J.L. Wilson and Tom Fahey, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, J.L. Wilson with Associated Oregon Industries, and with me is Tom Fahey, who's the Vice President of Siltronic in Northwest Portland. House Bill 3352 does two things. It amends ORS 652-010, which is the legislative declaration from, as what I can tell, from 1923. That states that it's the policy of the state that no person should work in a manufacturing facility for more than 10 hours. And if you go on to read the chapter, it says that working more than 10 hours is injurious to the physical health and well-being of such a person and tends to prevent the person from acquiring that degree of intelligence that is necessary to make the person a useful and desirable citizen of the state. It's an antiquated statute, an antiquated policy, and it specifically limits the amount of time that someone can work in a manufacturing facility to 10 hours. Now, Section 2 of the bill, we amend ORS 652-020, and this is the statute that says that you have to pay time and a half for time worked in excess of 10 hours per day if you work in a manufacturing facility in this state. It also imposes the 10-hour rule on any mill, sawmill, planing mill, shingle mill, and logging camp for more than 8 hours per day. Now, the interesting thing about this statute is that ORS 652-030, which is not included on your House bill, goes on to basically repeal 652-020 unless, and these are for the mill facilities, unless California, Washington, and Idaho adopt similar statutes, which they haven't. So the daily overtime rule does not apply to basically anybody listed in the 652-052 statute except for manufacturing facilities. And so House Bill 3352 before you today proposes to remove manufacturing facilities from the 10-hour daily overtime requirement that exists today in 652-020. I have in my written testimony what other states are doing with regard to daily overtime, and quite simply, other states are not doing daily overtime. There is an 8-hour daily overtime rule in Alaska that is chock full of exemptions. Most notably in small manufacturing, small forestry, small logging mills. In California, there's an 8-hour daily overtime rule, except for the fact that manufacturing is completely exempted. In Nevada, there's an 8-hour daily overtime rule, and it only applies to low-income workers earning less than $12 per hour. There's a 10-hour daily overtime rule consistent with Oregon's that it also appears in Florida law. But that is only for, and this is the Florida statutory term, manual labor. And then there is a 12-hour daily overtime rule, which is a blanket overtime rule in Colorado. So Oregon is one of a very few, it might be the only state other than Alaska that has a daily overtime requirement for manufacturers specifically. We're talking about House Bill 3352 today for two reasons, one of which is the competitiveness issue for Oregon manufacturers because we are so manufacturing reliant. The second issue, and this is one that Tom will allude to, is a number of our manufacturers want, and I would say their employees, want to go to a system of two 12-hour days. Excuse me, of running two 12s. So the employee, in essence, would work three 12s 1 week and four 12s the next week. It's an issue of employee workplace flexibility. Employers, I can say, are reluctant to do so because what under Oregon law, you end up paying 6 hours of overtime on a 36-hour short week, which is an impediment to something that both employers and employees desire. So that is the reason and the impetus for the bill. I'll turn it to our expert, Tom Fahey, to talk more about it.
Thank you, JL. Morning. My name, as JL mentioned, is Tom Fahey, Vice President of Human Resources at Siltronic. We're a manufacturer of silicon wafers in Northwest Portland. When Siltronic first came to Oregon, which is 33 years ago now, we adopted what was fairly common called rotating shifts. And rotating shifts are essentially where employees work 1 week on day shift, a couple days off, another week on swing shift, a couple days off, another week on graveyard shift. And they have about a three or four day break, then they start the cycle again. Well, we found that this shift was very damaging to employees' health. You can just imagine the sleep challenges with something like that. And also family issues. So the employees were very much in favor of changing from that kind of a rotating shift schedule. And we verified that it wasn't just our employees. We went out and worked with consultants on this and found that in a lot of the publications and things, this is a very common problem. You see this a lot. You talk about circadian rhythms, if you're aware of that and what all that is. So, and I personally worked that shift myself when I started with the company 33 years ago, so I know how damaging that is. So in 1981, we adopted the 12-hour shift schedule that we still use today. And it's the shift schedule that JL just mentioned to you. And we found that it works very, very well. They essentially, in a two-week period, they work 7 days. And the employees love that schedule. And as JL mentioned, 1 week is a 48-hour week. And they get 8 hours of overtime in that week. That will not change under this bill. They will still get that because of the 40-hour rule. They will still get those 8 hours of overtime. But it's the short week. That is the week where we're essentially paying overtime after 30 hours, as JL mentioned. And that is very difficult from a competitiveness point of view. And we would... I don't like to point fingers at other countries, but it seems to me like France. It seems like we're becoming more like France, giving overtime for such a low level. And frankly, the employees like this schedule. If I even, well, and we've surveyed our employees, and if I even suggest moving from this kind of a schedule, I know I'll have mutiny among the employees. They really enjoy this schedule. It's very easy to plan ahead of time, plan their time off. They take 24 hours of vacation. They have 7 days off in a row. They really enjoy the schedule. And they get lots of rest in between the shifts, too. I'll point out that even in that 48-hour week where they work 4 days, they're not 4 days in a row. They never work more than 3 days in a row. And I know safety is a concern when people think of working 12-hour shifts. But we've found right now, in our 33-year history, our safety performance has never been better. If you're aware of the workers' compensation experience modification measurement, the what's called the MOD rate, 1.0 is the average of industries our size and in our industry area. Our experience MOD is 0.83. which is significantly below average, and that's very good. And it's never been lower, and it keeps going lower with the 12-hour shifts. Now, I'll point out that last year was a very challenging year at Siltronic. We had to close one of our plants. We had to eliminate 380 jobs. Those jobs went to foreign locations. So as JL mentioned, this is a very important competitiveness issue. If we were more competitive, we may not have lost those jobs to foreign sites. So we have a remaining plant open with 400 jobs right now. We're working very, very hard to retain those jobs, to be as cost competitive as we possibly can. And we're in a global market, so we absolutely must be competitive, not just locally, but globally. And this kind of assistance to get rid of this 10-hour overtime rule would really help. And you'd be surprised how small steps like this really help our competitiveness here in the state. So there is one other small point I'd like to make, and this might surprise you, but it's an environmental point. And because the employees only commute 7 days in a two-week period instead of 10 days in a normal two-week period, there's 30% less commuting. And so I know you have on your minds issues of road congestion and air emissions and things like that also. That's another reason the employees like their shift. They're only commuting 7 days in a two-week period. And believe me, that's significant savings in their pockets when you look at the price of gas these days. So I would like respectfully ask your consideration to this bill. I think it's a very, very good move for the state, for competitiveness, not just from a business point of view, but from an employee health point of view and a competitiveness point of view. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the panelists?
Madam Chair, just one.
Yes,
thank you.
Representative Matthews.
I'm just kind of curious, if this is your business model, these are your known hours, and this is known calculation of overtime that you have to pay, is that not factored into the hourly wage that you start to pay folks anyway?
No. No. We have to offer a competitive hourly wage.
Okay.
And for example, night shift is also a night shift differential, so all of that's on top of the competitive hourly wage.
Okay. That's fine. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have Elena Guinea, Janice Rabe, and Mike Sullivan.
Good morning, and thank you, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ilana Guinea. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon AFL-CIO and our 250,000 members, including a few thousand who work in various manufacturing and other industrial jobs in our Oregon economy. I want to clear up a few things about what this bill does and doesn't do and point out a few realities within our current economy. First, this bill doesn't change the flexibility that workers or employers are allowed. There are hundreds of companies across Oregon, probably thousands, who work 12s. When you're running a 24-hour facility, it makes sense to either have 3 8-hour shifts or 2 12-hour shifts. You don't work 10-hour shifts. It doesn't make sense. You don't need that overlap, and you don't need the awkward 4 hours left at the end. We're running 12-hour shifts in Oregon. We've got members across the state who work 12-hour shifts. I was hoping to have a steelworker with me here today to attest to that. Unfortunately, he got called into something else. But this bill doesn't change the flexibility that companies already have. Second of all, you heard that this policy is outdated, that many pieces of it are conditionally repealed in other parts of the law. This doesn't repeal the offensive language that's in our state statute. If industry is interested in repealing the moderately offensive language, which suggests that Oregonians aren't able to work 12-hour days, we'd be happy to work with them to do that. But that's not what this bill does. This bill leaves that language, in fact, in our statutes. What it does is simply removes two classes of workers from that language, factory employees and those who work in manufacturing establishments. And what it says is that those two classes of workers don't deserve to make overtime when they're working really long days in what are often conditions that are much more difficult to work in, much more strenuous to work in than those that we face in this building. We know that Oregon wages are below the national average. I think we all want to change that. I'm not really sure why we're talking about lowering workers' wages as we're trying to change that. And frankly, it's my understanding that Boley has worked with businesses when there's agreement between business owners and their employees that they'd like to work 12s to find a way to do that under the current law, whether that's by granting a waiver to this law, whether that's by saying there is agreement written down through a collective bargaining agreement, through some sort of agreement outside of a union condition. Businesses are allowed to do this. Boley makes it work for them. It's happening every day. We don't need a law lowering people's wages, and we don't need to use offensive language as an excuse to do that when we're not actually changing the language in our statute. I urge you to vote no on this measure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next. Good morning, Chair Doherty and committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. AWPPW opposes this bill. And I am a former steel worker. In the 1980s, Cascade
Mr.
Steel.
Mr. Sullivan, just for the record, APBAW stands for.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It's alphabet soup, but it's the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers.
Thank you very much.
In the mid-80s, the melt shop, if you're familiar with steel processing, is pretty, you know, rigorous department to work in. The divorce rate was extremely high. The gentleman before me was talking about the 21 turn. And in some instances, when you back into your graveyard shift, you really only get about a day and a half off. So there was literally insurrection in the plant that the 12-hour shift was what the melt shop wanted. They went to see Mary Wendy Roberts, then the Boley, head of Boley, Bureau of Labor and Industry. She came out and toured the whole plant, interviewed virtually everyone on the issue. We had to call a special meeting and vote on this issue because it was so volatile. And even today, there's majority of them work 12-hour shifts, but there's still people that work 8. 12-hour shift is convenient in the sense that it gives you time off or the illusion of it, but you have to recoup. And then you have to get your mind back into your work manner when you return. So it's not la-la land, if you will. So the workers did that because of the 21 turn. It wasn't that they really wanted a 12-hour shift. There wasn't much of an alternative to it. And to Representative Matthews's point, there had to be a renegotiation of the wages because they had to be dropped for the 12-hour shift to compensate the same rate as a 10-hour shift. Then, if you have a reduction in force, you've got all this paperwork you've got to do to bring everyone back down to 8 hours. It's a mess, really. I can't tell you enough how much I don't like a 12-hour shift. And I had to work 10s eventually. For a young person in your 20s, I'd say, that's great, hurrah, let's go camp. But not when you get in your 50s and 60s, it isn't. I would ask you, please, not to move this bill forward. Thank you. I'll answer any questions that may come up.
Thank you very much. Denise?
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, my name is Janice Rabe, and I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Workers Justice Project. We urge you to vote against 3352. Just three basic points. 3352, we're concerned in Oregon about having living wages for workers, and 3352 would lower those wages. We also want to put more people to work in Oregon, and if you're requiring overtime and you're having people work overtime, that doesn't create more jobs. It just it stops that. And finally, on the point of safety, in where this, as I understand from Ms. Guinea, where this is effective is in factories and manufacturing. This is the purpose. Mr. Wilson talked about this law going into effect in 1923. Yeah, these things are about a century old for reason. There were safety concerns, and there remain to be safety concerns. And if you have people working long hours in things like manufacturing, factories, you are going to have safety issues, and it's only increased with the amount of time that they work. And the previous speaker reminds me of this in terms of, well, you get 12 hours on and something off and come back for 12 hours, you're just not going to have recovered. This is going to be a safety issue. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any questions of the panelists? Representative Widener?
Actually, Mike, this would be for you. How long has it been since you worked at the steel mill?
Chair Doherty, Representative Widener, I retired from Cascade Steel in 2004.
Because a lot of the guys or buddies that I have that work out there, they actually like the 12-hour shifts, so that's why I'm kind of curious if there was ever a poll or did you guys take a vote if they wanted to do the 12-hour shifts out there?
Chair Doherty, Representative Widener, we had a special meeting on the 12-hour shift, and that's how it got established. Okay, so then when there's a reduction in force, they have to go back down to an 8-hour shift. The people are used to a 12-hour shift, so it can be a problem when they go back to 8s because it's a matter of readjustment. But again, back to the idea of the length of a 12-hour day in time, it pays its toll or does its toll on people as they age, actually.
Thank you. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do any of you have statistics on injuries possibly increasing with an increased length of the workday?
Chair Doherty, Representative Witt, I was looking last night and could not find in time a study that came out a few years ago that compared safety issue occurrences as hours increased to, it didn't look at safety in the workplace, but it compared your reaction time as your work hours increased to what your reaction time would be if you were drinking. And I think it was between 10 and 12 hours that your reaction time lowered to what it would be if you had had a few drinks. After 12 hours, it was substantially worse. So that the effect started to happen between 10 and 12 and then kind of skyrocketed after 12. I will continue to look for that after the hearing today, and if I can find it, I'll get it to you all. It is a few years old, though.
Thank you very much. Other questions?
Madam Chair, I was wondering if Mr. Sullivan might have any information from the Plant Safety Committee about any correlation between accidents and length of the workday.
Chair Doherty, Representative Witt, I was the union safety chair for years, probably eight. With the introduction of the 12-hour shift came amphetamines. In fact, my one son played baseball with a melter, which is a boss in the melt shop, and he bragged to me how he was passing out the drugs on the shift. He was, of course, later fired. But that's where we ended up with a last chance agreement. And we had to really up-tool our employee assistance program to get on the bottom of this problem, get to the bottom of it, I should say.
Yeah. Okay, Madam Chair, will we be hearing from Oregon OSHA on this bill?
Not that I know of, no. We can pass a question along to them.
Thank you.
And so if you get the question, we'll pass it along, get the information to the members. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, no one else has signed up. I see no one running to the dais. So I close the public hearing on House Bill 3352, and I open up a public hearing on House Bill 3436. Senator Beyer? And who else wants to come up with Senator Beyer? And Mike Salvaggio? Okay, Jan, if you could summarize the bill, please.
Madam Chair, committee members, committee heard this bill last week. It's a bill that establishes the Oregon Retirement Savings Investment Board, and they're to develop recommendations for establishing a secure retirement plan. and to report to the Legislative Assembly December 2013 and then again in September 2014. Okay. Declares an emergency.
Thank you. This is actually a bill that we started opening up a hearing a week or so ago. Did not have time, so this is a continuation. Senator Beyer, welcome.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, I'm Lee Beyer, State Senator from District 6, which covers Central Linn and Lane counties, and appreciate this opportunity to come and talk with you this morning on this. I've got a bunch of notes here, but I'm not going to use them. I think this is a simple idea. As you look across the country, and I think intuitively, some of us are my age, others are much younger, but if you look at that, the landscape has changed in retirement programs across the country, and not very many opportunities exist in the private or the public sector in many places for people to just participate without thinking in a retirement program. Many have gone to direct investment. The thing that concerns me, has concerned me for a long time, and I'm looking at the people coming into the workforce today and the younger ones. When you look at the national statistics from the professionals in the investment community, what you discover pretty quickly is there aren't a lot of Warren Buffetts out there. Most people, even though there are retirement vehicles out there, are not good at managing your money. And the concern that I have is frankly, it's not an immediate concern. It's what's it going to be like in 30 or 40 years from now when today's workers reach that retirement age. And I think there's a really good chance that the nation and our state will be faced in a situation that looks a whole lot like the late 1930s when Social Security was put in place. And as I was thinking about that, I thought, are there other options out there? And it struck me, you know, all of the discussions about PERS aside that we have today, the Oregon Investment Council and the programs, the savings that that group, that system makes for us and local governments collectively has been stellar. And in fact, if you look at their ability to perform and their record of performing, they have outperformed considerably almost all of the other investors in the country. So as I was thinking about that, I think, is there a way that we could make something similar to that available to our citizens as a standard way to a place to put their savings and get a good return on it, get good professional financial management. And I'll be frank with you, I don't know whether there is or not, but as I was thinking about it and talked with Representative Doherty and the Treasurer and others, they thought, well, that's worth looking at. That's really what this bill is about. It's a bill that would set in place a council, a task force, if you will, to take a look and say, is there a way we can make these services available that protect the state and don't get us into another problem, but would make available to the people a place where they could put their money and get good money management. This particular bill, what it does is it sets a process in place to do that with a report back to the Assembly in 2015 and will give that Assembly a chance to consider that wise advice from people in terms of can we do something that would be helpful to people without a drag on the state economy as a whole. So that's really simply it in a nutshell. We know we've got a problem facing the future, and we know that we have some capabilities to address that and professional management. And I think the secret to the management, quite frankly, if you look at the Oregon Investment Council, what I think has been just marvelous over the years there is we set some general parameters in place, we set a point of things, and they are able, collectively with the funds that, the amount of funds we have to invest, they're able to get the diversification in investments that protects and gets a good gain on investment. It's a marvelous system that we have in place, and I just wonder if there's a way we can make that available in some form to Oregonians as a whole. So that's it, Madam Chair, in a nutshell.
Thank you very much. And Mike, before you begin, Representative Bailey could not be here this morning, but he did submit his testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Silvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. And I've also submitted some testimony from the treasurer, and I believe I paraphrased it last week, so I don't want to go over it in a third way, but I'll just generally briefly say that the treasurer is writing today to express his enthusiastic support of this bill, as statistics are showing that less and less people are saving for retirement either through ability or convenience. We think that right now numbers show that more than half of us don't have enough put away for retirement in Oregon. And with our adult population projected to double in 20 years, this is quickly going to become a collective and communal problem as opposed to just a personal problem for those people. The Treasury believes that maintaining a healthy and financially secure elder population should be a policy goal of this state, and that's because of not only budget savings but also because of the personal bottom line. So, as the Senator noted, this bill takes a first step at addressing that problem. It establishes the Oregon Retirement Savings Board as an advisory body. It will report back to the legislature, I believe, twice before making a recommendation for legislation in 2015. And we don't know exactly what that plan will look like, but we do know that there are sideboards to ensure that it protects the state against liability, to pool resources to keep individual costs low, and to create a portable, accessible, and voluntary option for Oregonians. And I want to underline the fact that there have been a lot of questions, concerns, thoughts swirling around this issue generally about you know, what is and is not a good idea, what can we do, what can't we do. And I think that those questions are exactly the type of questions that should be brought up to this board. I think that that's the proper venue in which to have that discussion. So we're very enthusiastically looking forward to getting that set up. We're looking forward to bringing people together from the business community, the financial industry, the general public, and from the Treasurer's office to move the issue forward to propose a responsible and appropriate plan to the 2015 session. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Wanted to know, this bill calls for setting up a board. Do you anticipate that the Treasurer himself will be one of those members?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the bill allows the treasurer or the treasurer's designee to to appear on the board.
That's the reason I asked the question.
And I clarify that for the folks at home. The idea behind that is that the treasurer's schedule is generally busy, as the case may be. In prior instances of that, he's made a practice of being on the board, but then allowing for the appointment in temporary instances of appointing someone to take his votes for him if he's not able to make it. There are some boards that he is not able to show up at, but I'll give you the example of the Oregon Growth Board, where he generally goes to the meetings, but if he's not able to go to a meeting, he'll, for that meeting, designate a proxy.
Good questions? Representative Widener, then Representative Witt.
Right now, I'm going to guess, Senator Beyer, that this is investigative, but I actually love this concept. So, and to me, it's what we should be doing with Social Security, in all honesty. And I'm just wondering if the thought process is this a backup where we would manage, a person would just check a box and have 5 or 10% come out of their check to go into a fund, and then we manage that individual's money that's there all the time and just track it for them and try to draw some good interest to supplement their Social Security. Is that going to be your thought when you developed this?
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, you're farther ahead on it than I think we are. In terms of, I think that's a possibility. The question that I really, let me say it a different way. I think those are the questions that we would want the board to come back with and put a recommendation in front of the legislature. Is how can we do this? I think that makes sense. Probably all familiar with deferred comp plans and that. This would actually be a vehicle could be there. It wouldn't be the only one. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily replace all the other things that are out there that are available through insurance companies or stock brokerages or whatever. What I was interested in doing, one is, well, actually two things, encouraging people to do just what you're saying, make that commitment that they put just a small amount away every month to the extent they can. And secondly, to try and see if there's a way we can use the power of that investment council to their benefit rather than sort of picking and choosing. And that's the second part is my bigger concern is the track record is not good on people investing their own money so far. It's very hard. I used to do some of this a long time ago in my career, and I know that unless you're in it every day, it's really hard to do this, hard to get that management. So that's sort of the notion.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Whip?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I share your concerns about the inadequacy of retirement savings, and I'm wondering if either of you have any projections of how many years out into the future it will be until the majority of Oregonians are dependent almost exclusively on Social Security in their retirement years.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it is my understanding that, firstly, I don't have an exact year number for you, but it is my understanding that right now about a quarter of married seniors and half of single seniors rely on Social Security for over 90% of their income. So with that elder population expected to double in the next 20 years, I think that we've got a pretty good idea of
yes.
what that picture is going to look like in the next couple of decades.
Very scary. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. One's kind of a follow-up on Representative Witt concerning retirement savings. This would still require an action from the person to actually go through and save their money. I mean, so I'm not sure. How would this change it? Would it be more of a mandatory investment that people would be required to make to so that for their own good they can have retirement savings? Well, I mean, what do you anticipate towards that end?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, no, not mandatory. I don't think that's palatable, to be very honest. I think it's an option that you make available to someone to do that. Some will, some won't, I suppose. But that's the idea, that you make it there. And if they do, I think you add a sense of security to people's minds if they feel there's a confidence that if they put some money someplace, it'll work. And I think of it to some degree, it models after the college savings plans that we've adopted. Not everybody is putting their money into that for their children, but a lot of people who weren't otherwise are using that vehicle, and it's doing pretty well now. Had some problems in the start in Oregon, but across the board, across the nation, those plans are doing very well.
Thank you. And then my main question was, of course, we've been hearing for years about the crackdown. We're trying to crack down on financial mismanagement and financial industry and the wrongdoing. And there's a call for more regulation, more penalties, more oversight. Who would be the regulator in this case, do you think?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative, this is actually just the other side of that. And I guess there is some people would question whether they would have more sense in having a government entity doing it or not, but the fact of the matter is that if we were able to use the power of the Oregon Investment Council, that has one heck of a fine track record. And my hope would be that you could apply that money management skills to private investments. And there's some question in my mind whether we'll be able to structure that, but it's worth a look.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Representative Thompson, we got all the way down the line here.
I'm curious, we have a number of companies in Oregon that are offering retirement products now, and as to why a state program would be better, and the companion to that is I'm concerned that we'll miss the target. And you brought up the college savings plan, which is an ideal parallel. The families that take part in that are the ones that have the means to take part in it. We also have programs available for health savings accounts, and that's not been real successful for the population we'd like to target because they don't have dispensable income every month to put into it. And I'm just curious as to why you think having a state-run program would be better and would serve the low-income population that doesn't have any money to invest now. If we don't put any skin in the game, which I hope we don't in this, I'm learning from PERS myself. What's the difference here? Why is public versus private a better choice?
May I relay an anecdote?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to relate an anecdote because I don't have data to give the representative, but I think in large part, this is something that the board needs to be looking over as a, in terms of, is the lack of savings due to need and ability, or is it due to convenience? And I have a little sister who I'm going to embarrass now. she and I...
And of course she's watching, right?
I'm sure she is.
Absolutely.
She lives in California, and she's very addicted to the legislative feeds here. admittedly, we did not grow up with a strong savings culture around us personally. She has a job at a company that offers her the option to put some money away out of her paycheck. And she doesn't make an extraordinarily large amount, but she was able to check a box and just put a couple percent away with each paycheck. And that's not something that she would ordinarily have thought to do on her own if that wasn't a convenient option. She wouldn't have walked into a broker and started that kind of a savings account, but it was easy for her to do. And a few years ago when she wanted to buy a house, she said, you know, Michael, I think I'm gonna buy this house that I've been looking at. I said, well, that's a pretty bold move, but you know, you have to have a lot of money put away for that, for making a down payment. And then she just casually says to me, oh, well, I've got $20,000 in that savings account. And it blew me away because I hadn't even known that she was had an interest in personal finance. And to be truthful, she doesn't. But it was the convenience of being able to check that box, and she didn't have to make an extra trip to a broker or to a banker or to a financial advisor that enabled her to have that level of financial freedom. And I think that that's one of the things the board has to be looking at is how much of this can we really address through just simple convenience as opposed to those other issues about performance and lowering costs and that sort of thing.
And Madam Chair, if I can follow up on that, I think that's part of the answer. I do think that feature works, and it does work in businesses that offer that. The other side of that is in terms of where can you get the best return and the best professional money management. And I have to tell you that as I've looked at my fund's performance many times, which are not bad, but I've gone, I wish I could be all into the Oregon Investment Council because they're sure outperforming everybody else that I'm involved in. So that's kind of the magical side that I'm interested in seeing is can we get that kind of performance available for the common person? Don't know the answer to that, representative, but I think it's worth looking at. Now, that's the point of this bill, is not to make a decision on it. It's to make a decision to say, let's take a serious look and see, can we do something for the everyday Oregonian?
And I'm going to jump in here because we've been talking about this for a while, and I'm chair, so I guess I can do that. And what we were looking at with the idea of investment, and unlike Mr. Savaggio's culture, from probably the time I could walk, my father was saying, you need to save money for retirement. And so I did. And when I first started saving, I'm telling you, I mean, like 10 years old, I had a retirement account. First time I walked in, the first job I ever had, I said, what does the retirement look like? And so that was a different culture. But until I got enough money in a retirement plan or could afford to put more than $20 a month away or $50 a month, a lot of people would not handle my account because it wasn't big enough. And so I literally for years just had it in a savings account because it didn't amass enough. And when we were talking about this, that was kind of the idea. I mean, I only have $50 a month that I can save. Will somebody who is an investment advisor use $50? And so it was the idea of get to a certain point and then somebody would take over. So that was kind of the idea when we were hashing things around. And by the way, Dad, I saved a lot of money, retired early. Okay. Next. It was Holvey and then Representative Kennemer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess maybe my questions for the Treasurer's Office. I really like this idea. I think it's, you know, maybe serves a niche as such for retirement for people. But I specifically have a question about Section 2 of the bill where it declares essentially that the board is going to develop recommendations and that the plan must require employers to participate if they don't offer a plan, employers of a certain size. And even though it's a voluntary plan for the employees, I'm wondering if that mandatory requirement of employers will trigger ERISA. And I guess that's my question is, does it trigger ERISA requirements? And what impact would that have on the plan by making that mandatory piece of the bill?
Well, Chair Doherty, members of the committee, I can say with certainty that that is an issue that the board needs to look into and the bill requires them to look into. And not being an attorney, and even if I was not being able to speak as an attorney in front of this body, I can't tell you whether that does or does not violate ERISA. But that is exactly the type of thing that we feel the board needs to come together to look into, to talk to the feds, to talk to Department of Justice. And I believe there are provisions in the bill also that requires them to come back and recommend if it is incompatible with state or federal law, what in that needs to change. And I imagine that we'll continue that discussion if we bump into that.
And if we could move along with questions, we have quite a lengthy list.
Yeah, we do, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I just got a couple of things. I guess I want to think about it, because this is a pretty big issue in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I guess a couple of things. I mean, we're sharing some personal stories. My older sister is retired, and her and her husband are trying to live in a trailer on Social Security. Mm-hmm. Trying. So I think I understand this, and I understand growing up in poverty, it's hard to have that attitude that you ought to save some money because you're usually focused on trying to get through today. And I think there's pieces of this that I think are fabulous ideas. I guess I'm wondering about if we shouldn't brainstorm a little bit more and come up with better sideboards. You know, Representative Holvey suggested there's an ERISA problem. I think undoubtedly there's an ERISA problem. I also think there are a lot of other issues. You know, we had a cultural trust and a damage trust that were overseen by the legislature. We violated those trusts. I think there are a lot of questions about how we're going to set this up so that it's not a loan pool for us to use and those kinds of issues. I also think, you know, when you're going to have a substantial sum of money at risk, what's the state's liability? And what's this going to do to our credit rating? Because it has a phenomenal impact. And then I think there's another question as we're looking in this recession. There are a lot of people in the financial market. What's the impact on them? Does it give them new opportunities or does it decrease their opportunities or, in other words, reduce their income and compete with them? Thank you.
So these are more comments.
I think those are more comments and frustrations, but okay. I do think there might. Oh, and I guess if I may, one more question, Madam Chair. And that is, what consultation has there been in the development of this bill with the insurance and in the financial industry?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, very briefly.
Very briefly.
Yeah,
I believe.
Sorry, a big question too, but I think
believe
important.
The point of the bill is to bring exactly those people together with this board to have that discussion and consultation.
Thank you, Representative.
That was just the point quickly that I want to make, kind of for purposes of the discussion as we deliberate on this bill. To quote my colleague on the board or the committee from a different bill, I don't think this bill in and of itself is a big deal. This just establishes a board that the most
action the board can take is make a recommendation. All the questions that we seem to have about an actual plan being set up is stuff that the board will deliberate about. This is just creating a board that would make recommendations. So I don't think this board is, you know, to due respect to the folks who are putting forward, a huge deal. If we were to decide to plan an actual retirement plan, it would be a big deal. But this board is just studying the issue and making recommendations about if that's feasible and, more importantly, if it would violate ERISA. So just kind of for purposes of our discussions, I want to be clear on what this actual bill is.
Right. And we are writing down all of the comments that would go to a board. Okay. Any other questions?
Madam Chair, that's exactly the point.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you. Okay, next we have J.L. Wilson, John Mangan, and Jan Meekums. Yes. We remembered you this time, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, if you want to begin. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Mangan. I'm Regional Vice President of the American Council of Life Insurers. We are a national trade association of 300 life insurance and retirement plan companies, most of whom do business in Oregon. And I thought the discussion has been excellent so far, and I just wanted to kind of jump ahead and first give you a snapshot of what we do currently in the marketplace, and then I will point you to the letter and testimony that we submitted to the committee, as well as refer you to a letter and testimony from the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, SIFMA, another acronym. Now, they've also provided some material for you, and I've also provided the committee with a private legal opinion addressing the issue of what happens to employers when they are required to offer any kind of retirement plan, whether it be through a state vehicle or private vehicle. And those are for your referral, and I'm happy to answer any questions on them. Right now, I just want to tell you, maybe apologize a little bit, that we have not been able to get to the table with the sponsors to tell them and to tell you how much we're doing in the marketplace right now. We are actively and as part of our core mission trying to reach Oregonians at all income levels to make sure that they are aware of the need to retire, the need to save for retirement, and the need to find a vehicle to do that. And our companies are spending 100% of their time trying to get people to save in private plans. We work with private insurance agents and brokers, and we'll work with you in terms of a study or in any other vehicle we can to try to solve this problem, because all the comments that were made by the sponsors are true. We believe there's a retirement crisis in this country, in this state, and we need to do something about it. And the reasons people are not retiring are really important, and we think they deserve more study, though, and I think a couple of the comments of committee members have pointed out that it may not be a lack of access, it may be a lack of other things. In a survey that was just released this week by the Employee Benefit Research Institute, the things that are causing people not to put money into a plan are, number one, job insecurity. So they either don't have a job, or they're between jobs, or they're worried about their job. And the second thing is they're trying to make ends meet, and so they don't have excess income to put aside. Those are the things we really need to start addressing. But I did want to express our concerns with the way the bill is written. We think goes a little bit beyond the study that has been talked about. We are open to and would support further study and would love to come to the table on that issue. But this bill actually does require the investigation of plans that would require employers to offer a retirement plan. And we believe that any requirement on employers to offer a plan, even if it's voluntary, will subject those employers to what's called the Employee Retirement Income Security Act that Representative Holvey mentioned. And that's a protection for workers at the federal level that says when an employer offers a plan, then they need to take extraordinary care and steps to make sure that workers are protected. And that means they need to communicate, they need to protect the funds that they're managing, they need to ensure that they report, and they need to make sure the employee is protected. We think by requiring employers to offer the plan, you will trigger that ERISA requirement, and that's going to cost employers a lot of money and a lot of effort. Mm-hmm. And before you do that, we would just caution that perhaps we should step back and study the larger issues, which we'd be happy to work on, and that this bill could be amended, I think, as Representative Kennemer said, to put some guardrails around it so that you're not going down a path and making perhaps promises to people that this could be something that could easily be done without cost, without liability. We think you could protect yourself from that with certain protective amendments. But as the bill stands now, we do think it creates a problem, and we would urge you to sit down, hopefully, with us and talk about how we could fix it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jan Meekums. I'm the State Director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business, representing 7,500 private entrepreneurial businesses in the state of Oregon. We find this bill troublesome for many of the reasons that have been mentioned. Number one is the fact that first of all, I'd like to say, with all due respect to the issue that's being addressed, we also share the concern about our employees and their retirement, their ability to retire, their ability to have a quality life in retirement. So it is an important issue, and we do respect that this bill is an attempt to address that issue. That being said, we're very concerned, which was already been said by Representative Holvey and my peer, that this is a requirement. This, as it's written, would be a requirement on the part of private employers, but it's voluntary on the part of the employee. And as I understand it, I'm not as well versed, that offering a retirement plan does kick in the ERISA requirements. And as we know, small businesses are small. They don't have HR departments. There would be administrative requirements that would be a tremendous burden for small businesses. And I believe in the college saving plan that was an individual opportunity. It wasn't done through the employer. It wasn't mandated. It wasn't a mandated option through the employer. So that would be a difference in that plan. In our opinion, developing and overseeing retirement plan for the private sector is beyond the scope of the state government. That's something that should be left up to the individual and to private enterprises. As was just mentioned, they spend 100% of their time. It is their business. They know it well. It's been developed over decades for many of these companies, and that is available to the private individual at this time. We know that PERS, we hear every day that the government is underfunded, it's understaffed, that there's issues with PERS, and then to take on and develop another segment of government to oversee a retirement plan on the private sector, we feel is a slippery slope and not a direction that Oregon should be going at this time. We would like to be at the table if this goes forward with more discussion, but at this point it would be very difficult for our members to support this bill as we see it as very burdensome and challenging. Thank you for your time, and I'm open to any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. J.L. Wilson representing AOI. Mr. Mangan and Ms. Meekum's testimonies represents the AOI's position. Our sensitivity is also toward government competition in a private marketplace, which is a sensitivity of AOI. So thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions of the panel? Mr. Representative Fagan and Representative Widener.
Thank you for your testimony. I think I'm a little bit confused because, again, this bill does not set up a plan. This bill does a study. In fact, I believe that you testified it would be great to be involved in doing a study. In fact, in the bill under Section 1, the required members of the committee are two representatives who have experience in the financial industry or pension plan. So as the bill is written, the governor is required to appoint two members from your industry to this board. And to Ms. Meekum and Mr. Wilson, two of the members have to be employers. So I don't understand the fear of having people study this and look at. I could certainly see you coming forward in 2 or 4 years and opposing an actual plan that's developed that's about to become law. This is just saying let's look and see if there is a plan that we can find that doesn't violate ERISA. And by law, employers have to be two members. Members of the financial industry have to be two members. So I don't understand the problem with just looking at this and, in fact, by law, requiring that two members of your industry and of your industries are part of this board.
Madam Chair and Representative Fagan, I think that's a great question I'd like to address directly, which is the difference, I think, is that the bill does trigger an expenditure of time and resource to do a lot of work and a lot of study. And we'd like to just fast forward a little bit and note that we think we know how it's going to turn out in terms of your concept, because the concept is a required program for employers to offer a voluntary option to employees. And it sounds good. But what we're concerned about is that we know where that end game is going to end. And part of the reason we know is because we were deeply involved in a California legislation last year. I was personally involved, which had the exact same concept. And the legislature and the governor actually determined that before you go down that path and spend a couple of years, because this could take a couple of years, to study the ERISA impact and the IRS impact, because part of this is the way it's set up could disqualify the participant from favorable IRS tax benefits, which we all want in our plan. And so we think those effects could happen, and California agreed. California is actually doing a study on this very subject. They're going to spend 2 years and about $2 million, and they're going to be requesting actual opinions from the Department of Labor, which is ERISA, and from the IRS to see if this type of a plan is feasible and will not cause the state liability. So maybe what we're suggesting is perhaps look at the California example and let them do the study, because it's going to be expensive, and then see where that leads you.
Borrow it.
Yes.
And then we can borrow it.
You could borrow it. Yes.
May I address it as well? Chair Doherty and Representative Fagan, I think to add to that just a little nuance, and that is, as was mentioned, that we feel that the state overseeing a private sector retirement funds, and that would probably ultimately require the private sector to do something and would be additional administrative burden, is not a direction that we can support going. So on that basis, the task force would not be something that we would support, because it's obviously, like was stated, a lot of time and energy in a direction that we would not support going. So that was my point.
Okay, thank you. Representative Widener, then Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my comment or question on this is a little bit, because you heard that I was actually kind of in favor of this, but I have all the same concerns that you have. But as someone who's owned a small business that could not offer a retirement plan, and someone who's started my work career for companies who couldn't offer retirement plans when I was 20 years old, 19 years old, 18 years old, sure would have been nice to be able to just check a box to where I had funds going to. Because right now we have Social Security that is just paying for the people that are going on. We get nothing back from that. So for me, as a small business or employer who couldn't retire, or basically get a retirement program for employees because I couldn't afford to, something like this would have been ideal. And for someone who's going in to work for a small business like that, knowing I'm not going to be there my whole life, if they have a retirement plan where I have to wait 7 years to be vested in the program, why would I put a dime into it knowing that I'm not going to get anything back if they're matching or anything like that? So it kind of disincentivizes the person who's in a lower income job or a smaller company from investing the way we have things set up now. So I'm looking at this where we could come together, and this is a board right here, but what sideboards would you want to see on it to get us there? Because people don't invest for those reasons that I just mentioned, and it's a big issue, because Mike, when he was up here testifying from the treasurer's office with his sister, was ideal. The only problem I had with his testimony was his sister gave up the money to buy a house so she could pay more taxes. So anyway, comments on that.
Madam Chair and Representative Widener, again, an excellent concern. But what if I were to tell you, and I think the agents who are going to come up in a few minutes will tell you, that there are plans available for small employers, medium-sized employers, that are simple, easy to install, and widely available, which allow a payroll deduction without the ERISA component or without state involvement. and those are called SEP, Simple IRA Plans. I have a small business on the side, and my agent set one up in about half an hour. It took about $200, and my employees began to payroll deduct into this plan, and they took it with them when they left. So we believe that those plans are available. But I think to address the second part, the treasurer does have some amazing resources.
Speed it up, please.
Yes.
If you can conclude.
But if he could offer those on an individual basis as opposed to an employer basis, I think that would be more feasible.
Okay. A quick question, Mr. Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you have legitimate grounds to be concerned about ERISA implications here. If we were to amend the bill and leave out the requirement for mandatory employer offerings, would the life insurers and NFIB be able to support this bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Witt, I think if the bill were crafted as a study that it didn't have an outcome predetermined and we were at the table, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I would say we would be much more open to the bill as well, but would have to see the end result.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay, any other questions? Thank you very much. Next people we have up, and we're going to keep your testimony very short. We have two other panels to go, or two other bills to deal with this morning. Joyce Demonen, Lily Hoag, and Andrea Peluso. And if you have written testimony, please just summarize it quickly. Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Joyce Demonen with AARP Oregon. We have about 500,000 members in Oregon. And one of the big advantages of my job as outreach director is I do get to talk to thousands of Oregonians every year. And I'm always surprised and worried about the number of people who really don't have retirement savings. And I just wanted to tell my personal story because I think it's very indicative of people in their 50s and 60s, which was when I was in my 20s and 30s, I worked at a variety of jobs, never had retirement savings from one job to the next that sustained, and I had a pretty good career in my 30s at the Corvallis Gazette Times. But after a divorce and my parents were getting older, I decided to move back to Portland from Corvallis and start over again. And I went back to graduate school, got a really good job, and I talked to a financial planner, and she basically said to me, Joyce, you cannot get there from here. And I was really, really freaked out, and I felt lucky that I actually talked to somebody because it changed everything about the way that I planned. But I thought I was doing everything right. So I would just want to add to the comments that have been made already that we know the world of work is changing now. Nobody expects to work someplace when they're 25 and stay there 30 years, get a pension and a gold watch. That's not the world we live in. We live in more episodic work, and we have to come up with a solution that actually works for people. I think one of the things that you all know, AARP is very involved in the campaign for Oregon seniors and people with disabilities. The state looks at how are we going to pay for senior services. The problem will only get worse if people are not saving for retirement. We have a crisis that is a personal crisis that ends up being a public crisis as well. So I think we need to adapt to the changing times and the world of work we're living in. And, you know, in my travels around the state, people always say, you know, I'm going to work until I die. And it's a joke, but it's also not a joke. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that we never know how long we will be physically able to work, if we're going to stay healthy, or if we're going to lose a job to the recession or people pulling out or downsizing. We heard we're in a global economy today. So we think that HB 3436 starts this conversation in a really proactive way, in a way that the state needs. Our Oregon needs this. We need to find a new way, an Oregon way, to help all of our citizens plan ahead and save the problem of saving for a secure and safe retirement. I think this is a bold and exciting idea, and it's kind of exciting to me. It's Tom McCall's birthday. I think he would absolutely love this idea. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andrea.
Good morning,
Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Peluso. I'm the Executive Director of Family Forward Oregon and the Family Forward Education Fund. I wanted to just give a bit of context to the problem that we're seeking to address. I'm here because we as an organization advocate on economic security issues that impact women and working families in Oregon. And I want to talk a little bit about how women are impacted in retirement and why I think this is a timely issue for us to discuss and something that I feel like we really as a state need to address. We have a lot of compelling data that is showing motherhood is now a leading predictor of poverty in old age. Motherhood. Having children. This is because women who have children suffer wage and promotion penalties due to their caregiving responsibilities. They, in the short term, lose wages that compound over time, leading them to less retirement security in the longer term. They're also more likely to work in part-time jobs with no benefits, like savings plans. They're often out of the workforce for periods of time while raising kids and or taking care of additional family members and see lost wages, but also lost retirement savings, lost periods of time where they're able to invest in a retirement plan and earn Social Security work quarters. This is particularly compelling because nearly 60% of a woman's retirement income is through, at least 60% of it is through Social Security. We know that women in Oregon are predominantly, retired women in Oregon are living in poverty in much greater numbers than the retirement population in general. 57% of the retirement population in Oregon are women. And if you look at the lowest quartile of retiree earners, 80% of those are women. So women are living in poverty and are not doing as well in retirement as men in general. And I think part of the problem and the thing that I think this bill addresses that's so important is the need to start a conversation about how we address this problem. Clearly, having folks living in retirement, living in poverty in old age is something that costs the state a great deal, and it's something I think we really need to be proactive about solving. What we're looking at is trying to address and have a conversation that creates something that's portable, that acknowledges that work has changed, that's flexible, that's easy to use, and I look forward to the conversations about what this will generate. I think it solves an additional problem, which is that many of the questions that have been raised today are about why folks just aren't saving now. There are vehicles to save now. And I would say the comments that have been made about the current system being very complex and hard to understand, that when we talk about women, and particularly mothers, who are both financially poor but also time poor, they are less likely to have the time to access the best advice and information about retirement plans. They're less likely to choose plans with the highest returns. They have less access to information and time to sort of wade through what their best options are. So I think the more we can simplify and make sure that we create something that's easy to understand, easy to use, portable, and that allows you to contribute during periods of while you're working and also while you're out of the workforce taking care of other family members, that's a critical piece of this.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Next we have Tom Simpson, Sven Anderson, and Matt Benjamin. And this, again, is to add anything that has not been covered. And if you have written testimony, please summarize, because we plan to finish this in 10. Thank you very much. You notice I'm a little time conscious.
A little bit. Yeah. Thank
you very
much. Tom Simpson, members of the committee. I represent Standard Insurance Company. We're happy to be here. And that may seem odd, because we just passed out our testimony, which says we're opposed to this bill. But we're happy because our elected officials are taking the same kind of interest in retirement planning that we do. This is something that we are experts at, and we're experts at helping Oregonians and other Americans prepare for these financially trying times of their life. Why are we not excited? We're not excited because, though Senator Byer's testimony did help add some clarity to what this bill's intent is, it reads to us like the state of Oregon is going into competition with us.
And so what we're going to be working on.
Right. So if you're going to add guardrails around this, it would be in that regard, because we'd rather not have that happen. So in this era of divisiveness, divisive politics, it would be great for the state and the private industry to partner together to come up with a common solution to get more Oregonians ready for their retirement.
Because I think that's been made pretty clear. And just for your information, we've been passing notes around. We've got some folks who will be spearheading the idea of talking to amendments with what your ladies and gentlemen have been
Great.
Saying on the business side. So we appreciate that.
Thank you, Chair.
Sir?
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Sven Anderson. I'm a local advisor and insurance and financial advisor here in Salem, Oregon. I've been doing this for 16 years. I'm also a member and incoming president for NAFA, which is the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. It's an association that represents agents at an advocacy level as well as our clients with inside the insurance and financial services industry. I would like to say that to some extent you're singing our song. We sing to our clients all the time, save, 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 save. It's very, very important. It's probably the key to any successful retirement plan is saving. It's not the rate of return, and it's not the special vehicle. It's not checking a box. It's saving, and that's a personal responsibility. So we're all about that. We applaud the efforts to recommend additional savings. What I'd like to comment on is a couple different items I've seen in my practice over and over. There's been some questions about why people don't save enough or why there's not enough retirement savings right now. To a large extent, it's been my experience that the reason there's not as much retirement savings right now is because some things that were stated earlier, but the economic crisis has required people to literally liquidate their retirement savings in order to survive over and over and over again. It's affected my income and industry tremendously. And the reality that, to comment from a previous testimony about women in retirement being more poor, many guys died before they get to that place. So many of my clients that are retired women are widows, and maybe they didn't have the life insurance or whatever that would have been necessary for them to continue on the lifestyle that they had originally. In addition to that, some other comments. The idea for convenience and savings is an important thing, but it can't be all-encompassing. And John Mangan's testimony regarding plans that are already in existence do exist, where people can contribute as little as $25 a month into a simple IRA plan that's available. It is portable. It is flexible. It can be convenient. All these things do exist. I think what would benefit our constituent, your constituents and our clients would be a culture of saving from the state government. That would be an awesome thing because that would promote it on an individual basis. I don't know that starting...
Summarize, please.
In summary...
Thank you, sir.
I'd like to suggest that in Section 3 of the bill on line 35, that the board may work with, contract with, or enter into agreements with private sector entities to develop its recommendations under this section. The ability to contract probably allows this board to go right into business and doesn't require them to come back to the state legislature and actually get permission. This bill actually gives permission or appears to give permission right now. So if this bill goes forward, it's more than a study. It becomes permission to move forward and then compete in an environment where there's tremendous opportunity right now. On my drive here to this building, I probably saw a dozen different places, banks, credit unions, insurance companies, investment offices that can provide all these options. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
It's okay. Thanks.
Would you like to, just for the record, say who you are?
Matt Benjamin. I'm a local financial advisor and also a member of NAFA. And, you know, same sentiments. And because I'm particularly loquacious, I'll probably just keep it.
Bless you.
Yeah. So we'll just add that. Thank you very much. And I know we will be working with Standard and others on this issue.
Appreciate it, Chair.
Thank you very much. Before you go, Representative Fagan, quickly.
For purposes of clarity, because we have to deliberate on this, that section does not allow them to go forward and make a plan. It says they can contract with private entities to develop its recommendations.
Correct.
So, again, all that this bill authorizes is a board to put together recommendations. It does not authorize anybody to go forward and actually institute a plan. So just for the clarity of record, I want to make sure that's...
The clarity of record is a plan of a specific nature, though.
True, but it's still a recommendation.
I understand.
It's not enabling legislation itself.
Yeah. Quickly, we need to move on. Do you have something to add? Or?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Could you give us some idea of, if I'm buying life insurance as a retirement vehicle, what percentage of my premium goes to retirement and what percentage to life insurance?
For Chair,
on average,
Representative Witt. I can't answer that directly. It would depend on the vehicle that you're purchasing.
Thank you.
I could just
quickly, please.
I guess is what he would be looking for is a variable universal life, whole life policy, and then actually if you just got it back to us in writing since we don't have time, then just plain buying term insurance and investing the difference between the two, what the return on all of them would be. Because I think universal and whole is probably pushed a little more in the industry from what I've seen.
Actually, this is not... thank you very much for your information. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Next we have Lee Mercer and Gloria McMurtry. Again, if you can keep your testimony extremely brief.
Chair Doherty and committee members, Lee Mercer with Main Street Alliance of Oregon. We're a network of small business owners around the state who speak for themselves on issues that are affecting small business around the state. We are speaking in support of HB 3436. Last week, we had two business owners here who weren't unable to testify for time constraints, and one was Deborah Fields from Paper Jam Press in Portland, and she wanted to... we're very enthusiastic, and our members are, about this opportunity and this idea, and she wanted to express the idea that business owners, as well as the employees, would have access to the deductions or the opportunity in this. And another person that was here last week was Jose Gonzalez of Tucasa Realty here in Salem, and he was concerned that it be structured so that commission-based people like real estate agents would also be able to participate. And I've submitted a letter from business owners signed on from Joseph DeCille Rock and from Portland to Medford that are interested in this. There's also some good quotes in that letter. I won't quote now, but we do have some enthusiasm in this, and we'd like you to support this bill. Thanks.
Okay, and some suggestions in your written testimony.
Yes.
Thank you so very much. Ann?
Good morning, Representative Doherty and committee members. My name is Gloria McMurtry, and I'm the former owner of Talking Drum Bookstore and Reflections Coffee House in Portland, Oregon. I started in my business 17 years ago, and I just recently retired. For years, the Talking Drum Bookstore was a hub of meeting place, a central place for African Americans in Portland to come. On our bookshelves, we had books that weren't readily available in Powell's and Barnes and Noble's and places like that. And it was also a hub for legislatures and other locally owned organizations in Portland. After 17 years of running the business, because of gentrification and competition, I finally decided that it was time for me to close the business because of my own exhaustion as well. When I was running the business, I did all that I could to help with my employees take care of various situations, but with the struggles to make things meet, I wasn't able to really concentrate on things like a retirement package, which is what this House Bill 3436 will do. And after pouring out my heart into this business for so long, I realized that I should have been putting some of those resources into retirement, because now all I had was my Social Security check and Medicare, which after 17 years in business, there wasn't a lot of Social Security check there. That's why a retirement security fund, such as envisioned by House Bill 3436, would be important for employees as well as employers. It would give us options to begin our retirement benefits right away from simply having a payroll deductible. So that's why I would urge you and the committee members to vote yes on House Bill 3436 to give myself as well as other employers the opportunity to start their retirements early.
Okay,
thank you for your opportunity.
Thank you very much. Any questions of the panel? Okay, thank you very much for coming down. Okay, we have one more person signed up, Roger Beyer. Bring us home on this one.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing multiple clients today. Those would be the Oregon Seed Council, the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, the Oregon Blueberry Commission, and also Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau, who could not be here this morning, authorized me to answer her objections or her concerns on the record also. I've heard the discussion, so I would just like to add some clarity. Our members are concerned about this. Our members are the ones most likely to be affected by this sort of a plan when private employers with a certain number of employees would be required to get into the plan. It gives us concern. Our members have employees who are very mobile, temporary, and the expense of tracking these employees is a great concern for us. We think if you move forward with a bill, please amend this bill, take into some of the recommendations that I've heard from the committee members now, put better sideboards on it. And I will try to be very brief, but one sideboard I would like to see put on the bill, as I've read this bill, I believe this bill is more than just a study. I believe this bill does allow for this board to move forward with a plan. There is nothing in the bill prohibiting that. It says they may work with private contractors to enter an agreement with private sectors to develop its recommendations under the section. If it is truly the intent of the committee and the sponsors of the legislation that this is just a study and the study would have to come back in front of the legislature to be approved, I would recommend you put that into the bill, that no action could be taken by this board until it is approved by the Legislative Assembly at some point in time. With that, Madam Chair, those are our concerns, and we'd be happy to work with the committee or members and the private sector people to, as this moves forward, to address some of those concerns. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of Mr. Beyer? Thank you. Very good input from all of the panelists. We appreciate it, and we're writing it down and are taking it to heart. Okay, that's the last person signed up. Anyone else? Okay, with that, I close the public hearing on House Bill 3436. And open up a public hearing on House Bill 2654. If you could, I don't know if this is an
order. Do you want to do the other? This is the public corrections.
Yep. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2654, the public hearing and work session, and instead open up a public hearing on House Bill 3361. Jan, if you could summarize, please.
Madam Chair, committee members, this bill defines what a comparable community is for the purposes of arbitration involving Department of Corrections security staff employees. There are no amendments before you, and there's no subsequent referral.
Okay, we have four people signed up, all in the affirmative. Tim Wolvey, Mary Botkin, Brian, and Brian DeLashmet. The other Brian, I could not count your last name, so. If you'd like to pull up another chair, we'll have one panel. Brian B. Thank you, sir.
Not a problem.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, and I'm actually not going to do much in the way of testimony. I just want to thank Representative Matthews for getting this bill introduced for us, and I have people here with me who can more than adequately talk about what the bill does and the reason for it, and I know you're short on time, so I will step back and only answer questions if I need to.
Well, thank you very much.
Good morning, Madam Chair Doherty and the members of the committee. My name is Tim Woolery. I am working for AFSCME Council 75 for about 9 years. I am the chief spokesman for the bargaining of that unit. And prior to that, I worked for the Department of Corrections for 18 years, so I have a lot of experience with this. Just a brief comment about the history of the law regarding arbitrations for bargaining. Prior to 1995, an arbitrator would look at both packages that might be presented to him and pick out the pieces that make sense and put it together in an agreement. After 1995, the law changed to have a specific set criteria of what the arbitrator would look at, one of them being the comparators. In the law, as it's currently written, there is specific guidelines to compare to the surrounding states. Then there's implied and there is no prohibition from comparing counties and other similar jobs. So what we're asking for in this bill is a simple clarification for the purposes of the arbitrator to review the materials presented to him should there be a contract arbitration. And that would be adding specifically the three most populous counties as well. A couple of sessions ago, the state police entered into a bill the legislature passed to compare themselves to the five most populous cities. The state police is the premier law enforcement agency in the state, and I support and believe that was a good decision by the legislature to do. I would suggest to you that the Department of Corrections is the premier prison-related industry, and we should be able to specifically compare to the three populous counties. Those counties occasionally have better wages than the state of Oregon, and as a result of that, we have a lot of our members that leave the state of Oregon and move to those counties to get employed. So we have a recruitment retention problem that this may help address. What we have is the new people come to the Department of Corrections, receive training, which is expensive, and then they move to the counties for a better job. And I'd like to stop that.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Brian Brandstetter. I'm a corrections officer at Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution. I've been with the Department of Corrections for 24 years. And I'm here to give testimony to the fact that I'm the frontline worker. I'm one of the people who gets to see what happens due to the disparity with the comparators. People don't understand when you have people that leave you, that have come to your department, we train them, they have to be there for a year on trial service, and then the counties absorb those people because of their pay is higher than what ours is in the state. The other thing is during the time that people get trained, it also creates a safety issue for all of us that work with inside the prisons. It's a piece of the puzzle that people don't see. How many up here get to work mandatory overtime because of a shortage, because the people leave and go other places? It's hard for those of us to see unless you get to see it. This will give us some tools that will at least give a comparator so at least it's even across the board. Most of the prisons got moved out of the I-5 corridor out into the east side of the state where I live. Getting people to move from the east side or from the west side to the east side and staying out there is a hard deal. If comparators are there, it helps us all. I'll cut it really short, but that's why I came, because it's important that everybody get to see what happens. And while the east side of the state is out on the east side, there's a lot more populace in the west side of the state in the I-5 corridor. So this helps all of us keep a safer environment for all of us, and the comparators make it an even playing field for the entire state. So thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr.
For the record, Brian DeLeishment, representing the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. I'll be extremely brief. I know you have another bill. We support the bill. The last numbers that I saw from our negotiating attorney is that the state employees in Department of Corrections are about 8% behind those in local government. That's what's creating the problem. Same problem we had with OSP. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. So, questions of the panel?
Sure.
Representative Matthews and Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for the testimony, and that's why I sponsored this bill. We have a problem, again, with recruitment and retention, and this is an industry we need to pay particular attention to because of the investment we make when we train people and the cost that comes with getting those people up to speed. If we continue to train somebody else's workforce, that's going to be bad for the state. So thanks for your testimony today, and I hope we can support the bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Widener.
This might be for Brian, but because we're 8% below, where we total package with benefits and everything, where do we fall?
That's the figure that Brian's referring to.
Is the total package?
Total compensation comparison.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Thank you
for
coming so much so far to testify. Okay, we have no one else signed up for House Bill 3361. Is there anyone that would like to speak on that issue? Okay, seeing none, I close the work session on House Bill 3361, and I open a work session.
Do I do both?
You close the public hearing, or?
Today.
Okay.
Public hearing, not work session.
So wait, pardon?
You closed the public hearing, not the work session, correct?
I closed it. Why do I always get those mixed up? I'm just anxious to go. I am closing the public hearing on 3361, and I open a public hearing on House Bill 2654. And we heard this earlier, but Jan, if you could summarize, please.
Members, this is the bill referred to as a social media bill. It prohibits an employer from compelling employee or the applicant to provide access to social media account or to add the employer on their contact list. You have before you a dash 3 amendment that deletes the provisions in the bill that were specific to educational institutions. And you have a dash 4 amendment that I believe Jim Craven from Tech America will be addressing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Actually, since this is my bill, I'm going to testify, but I'm going to testify from up here instead of down below.
Your guess might be summarized.
Thank you very much. And so I will put the gavel over to Representative Barton. But good morning. I am Margaret Doherty for the record, and I am the state representative from House District 35, and here to talk about House Bill 2654, the Social Media Privacy Bill. This is a bill that we heard first last month, and when we talked about the bill, we were still working with amendments. And I'm pleased to say that we still have amendments which we have brought to you, two amendments, and I look forward to passing the bill shortly. We have a few more amendments that we're working on, so we're not going to move the bill today, but we will have discussion on those amendments. I'm going to let some of the stakeholders speak to the amendments themselves, but I want to thank everyone who worked on this issue, including Tech America, the ACLU, the unions, members of the public safety community, and I have to say my diligent staff, because they worked very, very hard on this bill. We've also chosen to break this bill up into two parts. So the bill before you only addresses workplace concerns. I look forward to working with higher ed to address their concerns that they have. As to the bill itself, the details are below. Social media is an increasing part of our lives. People use it to stay connected with friends and family and to share the journeys of their lives. Sometimes social media users share intimate details about their lives, including religion, race, marital status, sexual orientation, and so on and so on. Unfortunately, some employers have been taking advantage of this collection of information and demanding access to an employee's Facebook or other social media accounts, sometimes going so far as to demand login information and passwords. This bill will prevent these kinds of abuses. So that was a summary of the bill. Do you have any questions of your chair? Okay, seeing none, I would like to call up Becky Strauss, Lana Guinea, and Mike Sullivan, please. And then also, thank you.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, Becky Strauss here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to participate in these ongoing conversations, and I think that we're getting to a place where we can have widespread support for this bill. I have been working with representatives from your staff and also from Tech America as we discuss in the initial public hearing to address some of their concerns. So we are engaged in ongoing negotiations about that. We have the dash 4 that I'm really going to leave to Jim to go through the different pieces, but what I would like to put on the record is that some of what's come out, I think, are just drafting errors in the dash 4. They're not necessarily substantive disagreements that we still have, but we do have concerns with some of the language that's been written in the dash 4. So I hope for the opportunity to continue to work on that. And then one substantive piece that we have not come to agreement on with the representative from Tech America is in the dash 4 on page 2, line 4 is essentially a provision that says that when an employer, nothing in the bill would prevent an employer from monitoring, reviewing, accessing, or blocking access to electronic data, et cetera, et cetera, and it goes on. Our concern here is that we're casting a much wider net over the target issue for Tech America, and I'll let Jim speak to that issue, but I think the language here is concerningly broad and doesn't necessarily need to be. in regard to the Dash 3, appreciate the, we're supportive of the Dash 3, appreciate the opportunity to work further on the concept in regard to higher ed, and hope we can do that this session. And I'll stop there and just be available for questions if we
need to. Dash 3 is just eliminate from this bill the higher ed component. Thank you, Mr. Sullivan.
Good morning, Chair Doherty and committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan, and I'm the Oregon political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, commonly known as AWPPW. I have not seen the Dash 4, so I will not speak to that. But the bill itself, AWPPW supports, because we've had problems with members being disciplined for at home using their computer, and the employer has gotten that, and people have gotten time off for saying derogatory things about their employer, or that the employer may be bad with customers or other employees. So we really think this is an overstretch of the First Amendment rights, and it really goes back to the old labor at, you know, saying 8 hours of work, 8 hours of rest, 8 hours for what with what we will. And we think that when we're home and we're off the clock, that we are not working for the company. And I'll answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Elena.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. First, we appreciate the chair bringing this bill forward to all of us. We are supportive of the bill. We are supportive of splitting the two concepts, and Jim Craven has been generous enough to work with us on a couple of specific issues around wording within his amendments, which I think we've gotten taken care of, although we just got the amendments back last night, so I want to give him a good hard look before I say for sure that that's the case. We will be moving forward, working with him to get you final language that everybody agrees on. This really is a growing issue within our labor markets, especially during the recession when there's a large pool of workers to choose from. And I think what stands out to us is that the list of all of those things that Representative Doherty put on the record as things that you put advertise on your social media accounts that you may not say in other places are in most cases things that your employer is not supposed to ask you during the hiring process, things that your employer is not supposed to.
Before you go on, if you could, you didn't identify yourself for the record.
I am so sorry. I thought I did. Ilana Guinea on behalf of the Oregon AFL-CIO. Those are things that your employer is not supposed to ask you during the hiring process. It's not supposed to affect your working relations. And if your employer is asking you for ways to get that information in a roundabout way, that's something that is really concerning to us. So we appreciate this opportunity to fix that problem and to work with folks who have a few concerns of making sure that it's done the right way and find language that we can all agree on.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question or a comment, which I suppose will lead to a question. I'd welcome your thoughts. So going to the original bill as drafted on the first page, Section 2, subsection D there, which is really the essence of the bill, essentially that we cannot require usernames and passwords. Mm-hmm. Now, I think most of us, okay, there's something just creepy about a prospective employer forcing you to give up a password, right? Right? It's just weird. However, it's the dependent clause there, or add the employer or applicants to the list of contacts associated with it, i.e., force them to accept a friend request so you can see what's already there. I kind of view those just instinctively. Those seem like two very different things to me. And while I think most of us are there on the password, again, that's creepy. Just being able to see what the person has, I think, posted on Facebook is not unreasonable in all circumstances. Now, I think there might be some, I think, that we've heard where it would not be appropriate. But you could think of a lot of hypotheticals that are not that far-fetched for certain jobs, certain industries, where a person's opinions are highly relevant, I think, to the private employer, and spokesman, for example, things like that. Does that make sense?
Chair Doherty, Representative Barton, a few of those specific situations I believe are addressed in
Great.
The Dash 4s. I think Jim can speak to those.
Great.
There is nothing in this bill that would prevent you from accepting a friend request on Facebook or a similar action in another area of social media from your employer if you chose to. There's also nothing that prevents your employer from looking at what's publicly available. There are various right. levels of privacy settings, and you choose what's appropriate for you. I happen to be Facebook friends with my boss. I also happen to have various levels of, you know, information that's available to different people, and that should be something that you as an individual get to choose. At a certain point, you create a sphere of privacy in your personal life if you want to. We all choose to work in professions where there's a lot of blurring between the lines of our public and private lives, but not everybody chooses to work in a profession where that's the case. And if you don't choose to work in a profession where that's the case, you should be able to say, I really want to keep these things separate in my life. And that's what this bill attempts to do, is give you that option personally.
Chair Doherty, Representative Barton, Becky Strauss with ACLU, and I just want to be associated with those comments, but also point your attention, obviously, to the word compel is in the bill, and I think that's the distinction here, is when you're in this dynamic between employer and employee, certainly there can be personal relationships that happen, and you can make a request that's accepted. I actually looked up the definition of compel before I came up here, which says, in Merriam Webster Dictionary, to cause, to do, or occur by overwhelming pressure. And I think that's kind of the distinction here, is when it becomes a condition of employment, I think that that's a distinction that we should make, as opposed to simply accepting a request from a friend.
Okay, thank you. Representative Widener, then Representative Fagan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make sure this is clear after listening to Mr. Sullivan. If you make derogatory comments about your boss on the public part of your Facebook page, they'll still be able to see that, and it's not a good thing for them to do if they want to keep their job or have a pleasant working environment. So I wouldn't want to give the false hope that this is going to give somebody complete anonymity to anything they might say on Facebook. People need to understand everything they put there is public for everyone to see. So this is just to protect the privacy information that they have behind the scenes, is what this bill's doing right now. So if they're posting stuff that's inappropriate, people are going to see it, and they probably should think before they post that stuff. So,
Chair Doherty, Representative Widener, certainly I agree, but like tomato is tomato for you and maybe tomato for me. And so it's a matter of interpretation. So I think individual cases may test that theory. But if the employer thinks they have the right to view the employee off shift and at home, then you are actually working 24 hours a day. Perhaps the employers would like to pay the employees 24 hours a day.
Okay, Representative Fagan.
I certainly appreciate those concerns, but I shared the kind of comment from my colleague on the board that this particular bill, to my understanding, does not, you know, for example, if I was friends with a coworker and I printed out that Facebook page and showed it to an employer and they saw derogatory comments, I don't, you know, elsewhere in the law there might be protections. It's not my understanding that this bill provides any protections for that. So just a couple comments. I think one can probably be taken care of in rulemaking. This is a new area, and so in employers, let's say my employer is Nike, and Nike has a Facebook page that everybody likes, right? They have, you know, 2 million likes or whatever. But then my individual supervisor at Nike has an individual personal page, and so they may want to be my friend, but they're not asking me to engage with the Nike page. They're asking me to be friends with them personally. And just to be, you know, in rulemaking, just to be clear, because this is just different than a lot of employee-employer scenarios. So just in rulemaking, for us to be clear that this means, you know, my personal page as a supervisor, I cannot compel someone to be friends with me on my personal page, regardless of the company's page. And then one oversight, I think, in the bill that you guys, I think, probably intend to cover, or maybe not, that I just noticed, is Twitter. You do not have to accept people to follow you on Twitter. So there seems to be a gray area in the bill right now. If I have a Twitter feed, can my employer follow me on Twitter without my permission? That is not covered in the provision of the bill saying they can't compel me to add to a list of contacts, because if people don't choose on their Twitter feed to have it be a request base, I'm not saying whether you should or shouldn't include that, but that should just be addressed one way or the other, whether that isn't included, because as of right now, that's not included in the bill.
Chair Doherty, Representative Fagan, I think the intent here, again, I'll return to the compel language, and I think in that instance, for example, a Twitter account, there isn't a barrier there that would be any different from public access. So in many ways, that is public access to kind of connect with someone, and I think there is the functionality on Twitter to have a private account. You need approval, and that would get a little bit more into the Facebook analogy. But I certainly take your point. I mean, the Twitter and the Facebook, we're talking about this in 2013. In as many months or another session or before the next session, there are going to be all sorts of other examples. And I hope that the language that we have here is broad enough to cover the advancements in technology, but hope that we'll continue to look at it if it doesn't.
Because this is not specifically just for Facebook. It is social media.
Right.
And Ms. Strauss is right. 3 weeks from now, we could have a different social media access. Okay, other questions? Representative Barton, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I suppose really just a comment. I find this bill actually more difficult in some respects than one might expect. And again, passwords, precluding employers from forcing to give up username and passwords, that's quite easy. That's just creepy. No, but I think we have a very easy time banning that.
If you could, however, summarize your question and make it a question, not a lawyer question. We have four more people that need to testify. Okay?
Madam Chair, please.
I'm going to ask you guys to ask questions and not make comments until we've heard everybody, okay?
No problem.
Just so they have time.
I've talked a lot today. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
No, you haven't. I hope you're feeling okay. Okay, any other questions of the panel? Representative Thatcher.
I'm actually not even sure if they're the right people to answer this particular question, but I just want to make sure that an employer, if they're supposed to take certain actions if they know or should have known about certain situations existing. For instance, if you find out that they're taking drugs, there are certain actions you might need to take. I'm just wanting to make sure that the actions taken and referred to in this bill don't preclude an employer taking appropriate action if they should find out something that they are supposed to take action on, like sexual harassment, something like that.
Chair Doherty, Representative Thatcher, that is not the intent, and the language should not do that. I will let Mr. Craven from Tech America had similar concerns from the ACLU's perspective. The dashboards are clarifications and in some ways not needed, I guess I could say, but I will let Mr. Craven talk about those concerns and how they are addressed in the Dash 4.
Yeah, good, thank you. If we could have Jim Craven come up. Now, any more questions to this panel? Because we do have three people more, Kevin Campbell, and all these guys are going to talk about the Dash 4, so at least two of them. Kevin Campbell, Jim Craven, and Will Atchison. And Mr. Craven has been working quite a bit with the Dash 4 amendments. He's our Dash 4 expert.
Thank you.
So if you could. He doesn't want to be our Dash 4 expert, but he is our Dash 4 expert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Craven from Tech America. Though on this bill, 2 seconds of background, Tech America got involved in this bill because obviously it's directed at social media sites, and all those major players are members of our national association, from Google to Facebook and Microsoft and Apple and Amazon and et cetera. So we got involved in this about a year ago as this bill started popping up in the states, as we say. I think there's maybe 23, 26 active versions of this going around the country. So we've been, we don't normally become before this committee discussing employment law. I'm maybe a little over my ski tips in this regard, but I think I've been designated by Mr. Wilson at AOI on this one bill to pinch hit on an employment law issue. So I'm not really here today on behalf of the technology companies as much as sort of general business concerns with the bill, as we shared back on the hearing on February 20th. And again, in the spirit of the Academy Awards, I do want to thank all of my co-producers of this bill, and particularly the chair, who's not just the chair, chair, but also the sponsor of the bill, and her staff, particularly Peter Sorensen, who's been playing shuttle diplomacy for the last several weeks in meeting with all the groups that have been working on the bill. So when we came before you in February, we talked generally about some of these issues. I know Representative Matthews had some concerns about the issue that was just raised about appropriate action investigation. So let me just tick down real quickly. There's about five elements in the amendments in the dash fours, none of which are exemptions from the general rule, the general creepiness rule that says, no, you cannot ask for passwords and login information, whether you're hiring or whether the person's an employee. However, some of these issues have come up around the states, and they've come up organically. Representative Matthews hit one unsolicited back in February. Representative Thatcher raised another one today. So let me just go through those really quickly, what's in the dash fours. So we put in, and I would say these are mostly what-ifs, clarifying comfort kinds of things, rather than there's no exemptions from the general rule in the dash fours. So one, we said that if an employer is not allowed to ask for this information, then there's no liability for failure to ask for it. You could say that's kind of obvious, but it is to say that, in other words, for failure to hire, improper hiring types of ideas. Number two, nothing in this bill precludes an employer from conducting an investigation when there are specific allegations of misconduct. And what this says is that they can have a conversation with the employee. They still cannot ask for their password or login information, but they can say there's an allegation, coworker to coworker, or there's an allegation of theft of company information, whatever. You're allowed to have that conversation with your employee. Number three, the issue that Ms. Strauss raised from ACLU on page two, lines four through eight, I think she called this overly broad. We think this language is very narrow. It's a little bit hard to parse, but what this says is that if you have a company IT system, which most companies do, some are very rigorous in terms of scanning, looking for viruses, looking for sometimes blocking access to certain sites that use up a lot of bandwidth, like YouTube. So employees are not using up the system during the day. So what this language says is that if an employee during the day, as I'm sure some employees do, actually check their Facebook page or log into personal Gmail account, this says that in a passive system, that password and login may be captured by the IT software as it's flowing through the system. This is just to clarify that that inadvertent capture doesn't constitute asking for the password. So we see this as very narrow, not broad, and it's part of companies' efforts to keep their IT systems secure. Four, there's line nine on page two, nothing in this section prohibits an employer from complying with other state and federal laws or rules of self-regulatory organizations. I think the chair maybe got a few letters from the securities industry on this, and this addresses, I believe, the concern that some of those national firms have communicated. There are some very complex SEC rules about employee behavior if you're in the securities business, even when you're like talking up your stock on your own personal Facebook page, that there are some very prescribed rules. This just says where those rules exist that are already law, we don't create a conflict.
And just real quickly, Mr. Craven's testimony is extremely important, so we are going to go after 10. Thank you.
Oh, geez, what service.
And finally, the fifth piece is that, and we touched upon this in the hearing, that says nothing in this section precludes an employer from looking at stuff that the employee puts out there for all to see. Again, that's a fairly obvious statement, but just to clarify, that question comes up in these conversations, so that's in there just to say that, and in that bigger debate that this bill doesn't solve everything in this brave new world of internet privacy, you put it out there, and I think specifically to Twitter, since Twitter is by nature, when you put it out there, you're putting it out there. An employer can read anything you put on Twitter, I think, because I don't think they have to log into your account. They just have to find it and identify it. So anyway, those are the kind of down in the weeds issues, but we've have found in this debate in various states and talking to companies that these are the kind of issues that have come up, so we've tried to put these protections into the bill while totally supporting the thrust of the bill and urging your passage with the Dash 4 amendments.
Okay. Dash 4 amendments. Thank you very much.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I'm here basically from a law enforcement perspective viewing this bill, and I want to acknowledge right up front that trying to keep track and on top of what is ostensibly a moving target of technology is difficult. I just got done testifying regarding drones yesterday, and I don't think we're going to be done with these issues moving forward. I also want to agree with the chair, Representative Barton, regarding the creepiness factor. I can understand, being a Facebook user, that giving a password and a username to anybody doesn't just give you access to public postings. It also gives you access to messaging, chat sessions, and other history, which are private in nature. And so we understand, even from a law enforcement perspective, the importance of providing that protection in an employee-employer or potential employer relationship. I do want to mention up front that for our police chiefs and leaders in police agencies, the importance of trying to hire the very best because of the public trust that we expect our officers to uphold is important. And so we try to find every way possible to vet people as thoroughly as possible before they're hired. Once they're hired, they are put through a 16-week academy and extensive training. It's bad news for the public and for the agency if they find out down the road that basically they would have been disqualified had we known additional information. That being said, I am not asking for an amendment today. I don't think I have the votes, and I'm not going to ask for an amendment that would provide an exemption, not to provide passwords, but just to view social media sites in the pre-employment context after a conditional offer of employment. But I do support the Dash 4 amendments. I think it's very important, and I think Representative Matthews in a previous hearing mentioned what kind of things can happen for both fire and police personnel when postings become problems in a criminal context, posting crash scene footage, posting information about pending cases, posting comments about people they've arrested. There is a long list of things that for the law enforcement officer represents what can be a disqualifying situation. I think it's important that we be able to keep on top of that. So with that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, with the Dash 4s, we'll support the bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Will Aitchison. I am here representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. Since Mr. Campbell is not going to be proposing a law enforcement exception to this bill, we're on board. We support it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And go ahead, Mr. Craven.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, one thing I forgot to mention. Though it's described as a social media bill, and we use the word social media, it's important for employers and people following this bill to actually read the definition of social media, because the definition in this bill of social media also includes personal email accounts, which we don't always think of as social media. It's the way it got drafted in the review process. We were going to suggest personal online accounts, which would be very broad and is really what the bill covers. But then council said, oh, actually, we use social media in the relating clause, so we just decided to let that battle go. But but people do need to be aware that this is not just Facebook-y kind of things. This is personal email. Any personal internet account pretty much is covered by this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for the clarification. Any questions, Representative Widener?
Thank you. A little bit of a comment, because people need to understand. They post, this is public, our youth, a lot of stuff they're posting is going to affect them on getting employment, because everybody sees it, and this is public information. I don't want people to start thinking that they're getting a false hope of security because the Oregon State Legislature is protecting them. It is not protecting them. It's just protecting their privacy from an employer upon hirement, and that's it. But their information is out there, public, everybody sees it. kids, if you're listening, because I know you tune into us all the time, watch what you're posting on Facebook and be smart. And adults, we've had teachers that have posted things that they shouldn't. Do not post things that aren't appropriate on Facebook or any social media site. That's my two cents.
You always remind children that grandma's going to see it, so keep that in mind. Representative Fagan.
Mr. Craven, that is a very good catch on the definition of social media. I hadn't even thought of it reading that way, but I would not want this to be interpreted as including the email account that your employer gives you, because there's definitely password sharing and password compelling happening in that context. And so that's a very good catch, and I think we would want to actually make it very clear, probably in statute, not just in rulemaking, that that is not included.
Madam Chair, Representative Fagan, I did not mention that point because that point was in the original bill, but it is covered.
If
it's slightly amended. It's line 9 on the printed bill. Line 20.
Right.
Where it says an employer may require an employee to disclose usernames, passwords, basically for company-owned equipment in the workplace. So if the employers, if they're paying for and servicing the equipment, have every right to, I mean, as my employer used to do, just force me to change my password every 6 weeks and not let me use one I've used in the last 4 years, which gets tired. You start running out of ideas. But, so that is covered in the bill. Thank you.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, that's it. So I close the public hearing on House Bill 2654. Any other business in front of us? I adjourn the meeting of the House Committee on Business and Labor for the 22nd of March, 2013.